You're tuned in to the Kojo Nam, the show on WAMU 88.5. Welcome. Later in the broadcast, we'll explore how D.C.'s food scene is changing neighborhoods in the city and in the suburbs. But first, on Tuesday, D.C. became the first jurisdiction in the nation to offer a non-binary gender option on driver's licenses. The policy allows Washingtonians who do not identify as male or female to pick an X instead of an M or an F. While the policy has been planned for months, it raises some practical questions. Once a city or state decides to support people who are neither just male or female, how does it go about doing that? Joining us now is the first recorded person in the United States with a non-binary driver's license. Nick Sakurai is the Director of Leadership Initiatives at the University of Maryland College Park's LGBT Equity Center. They join us in studio. Nick, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Let's start with a couple of the basics. Non-binary is a word used to describe someone whose gender is not exclusively male or female. Is there more to it than that?
Sure. I think that there are many different genders that have existed for thousands of years. If you look at many different cultures around the world, you can find this presently in Mexico and Indonesia. There are many countries that have been offering non-binary passports over the last 14 years. And even in the U.S., you know, of course, we have many different terms that people are now using to describe themselves, but we also have thousands of years of history among indigenous groups in the Americas.
What's the difference between someone who is non-binary and someone who is trans?
Well, some people who are non-binary would also identify as trans. Some might not. Trans seems to imply a transition, a changing, and I think terminology changes over time, right? And so even how people think about their gender, what does trans mean, and how does that work for some people and not work for other people? These things are changing, but I'd say there are many non-binary people like me who also identify as trans.
When I introduced you, I said they are in studio with us today, and a lot of our listeners must have been saying, wait, he just introduced one person?
Yeah.
But he said they. How do pronouns factor into all of this?
Well, pronouns, at least in English, are just words that we use to describe someone in the third person when we're talking about that person, when we're talking about them, and instead of their name, right? And so it's very easy. We do it with he, we do it with she. But there's also many, many years of history in English literature, including from Shakespeare, of the use of they to describe someone who maybe we don't know their gender. And more recently, also for people to identify themselves, for people who don't identify as a man or a woman. But some people, you know, for many people, these pronouns relate to gender, but they don't have to. They're simply a part of, you know, like I tell you my name, and that's how I want to be referred to, and I might tell you these are the pronouns I go by, but that doesn't necessarily tell you a lot about my gender. It just tells you how I want to be referred to in public.
Is it difficult for you to present your identity to the world? Tell us why or why not. What challenges get in the way of being accepted the way you are? You can also send us a tweet at Kojo Show or go to our website, kojoshow.org, ask a question or make a comment there. Nick, a term like tomboy might have been used to describe a non-binary person generations ago, but these words have gotten more specific, and they also seem to change with some frequency. Do you get the sense that some people don't want to talk about gender issues because they simply don't know how to?
It can be a bit complicated, and there are more and more terms that I'd say people are using now. But terms like tomboy, I mean, for some people that may be about identity, but you know, that may be a term more about gender expression or personal expression. A lot of the terms that and discussions we're having in this moment are also about identity. And I think what I would say is an important thing to note is that there are many different kinds of people who are non-binary. Personally, I don't think of non-binary as an identity for myself. It may be a political identity. And we see this changing. I mean, to be honest, we see this changing. First, non-binary is a category, right, of other identities. But I would say we see language changing in other spheres as well. We see language about race or culture shifting, like people hopefully won't call me Oriental anymore. And we know that we have to think about that that might not be an appropriate term. And I identify as Asian Pacific Islander. But where does the construct of Asian Pacific Islander come from? So I don't see this as like distinct or unique to talking about gender. I think the way that we talk about identity has political dimensions, has dimensions of culture, and has dimensions of how we describe our own experiences in the ways that are most accurate.
You are the first person known to have a driver's license with an X instead of an M or an F. For those who may be interested in following in your footsteps, what was your experience like getting this driver's license yesterday?
Well, to my knowledge, I'm the first person to get an X in a place where it's been regularized. And I know some people have negotiated getting gender-neutral identifiers in ways that are more under the radar. So some people might be going about it that way, that they're going to their DMV and asking and seeing what can be done for them. I think with Oregon also introducing the X marker next week, along with legislation in California and New York, I think policy change is an important route for people to advocate. And how that's done in different places is going to vary. One of the things that's exciting to me about being in D.C. is, yes, this may be new, but it's been ongoing, and the city has been very proactive. I wanted to, you know, proactively go after a neutral driver's license this past winter. And then I found out the DMV was already planning that and had been planning it since 2016.
Why is that important to you? Why is having a driver's license that reflects your gender identity helpful to you from both a personal and from a practical standpoint?
I think a lot of it's from this personal standpoint that I have an ID now that doesn't feel like it's a lie, that when I have to display it, that, you know, it's not saying something about me that isn't really true. So that's from a very personal standpoint. But I think it's largely, there's a symbolic piece that's really important to it. Driver's licenses and state or government ID cards are, I would say, the most displayed document of identity, right? And so knowing that another option is available for folks to be able to say either, and it's not just for non-binary people, the X is available to people who simply don't want to specify their gender on their ID, as well as obviously it's very helpful for people who are neither men nor women. But that's important because I think it opens up a conversation. And I actually think what's important on a practical level is a lot of the other policy pieces, things that we've been doing for, you know, over 10 years in the district with our human rights law. And I think that looking at those policies, practices, the training, the education that's going on because of those policies, this is just one symbolic piece that I think links into all of that larger picture.
One more question for you. Mm-hmm. Supporters of this policy change say that having another option for gender will reduce harassment that non-binary or trans folks might experience in security lines and other places. But sometimes labeling something gives others the ammunition they need to attack you. Could this policy have the opposite of the intended effect at times?
I think there's a couple things happening with the driver's licenses here. One is the X marker is available. But the other is that now people can self-designate their gender, which I think is very important because it gives people easier access to accurate identity markers on their driver's license. So even for trans people who identify as men or trans people who identify as women, that now has become easier to access. For non-binary people like me, the X marker, yes, we don't know exactly how that's going to play out when we display such an ID. I think there will be problems that some people will face, but it also is an opportunity by displaying the X to initiate a conversation about what that means, but also to say, I have the backing of my government as resident. So that's an important piece of it.
If you're a non-binary, how do you operate in a world that tends to give only two choices to you? Call us at 800-433-8850, email kojo@wamu.org, shoot us a tweet at Kojo Show. It's one thing for D.C. to provide a different gender option, but when other jurisdictions do not recognize it, would it just cause more confusion? Does culture need to change more for this policy to be successful? Well, speaking of policy, this is where our next two guests come in. Monica Palacio is the director of the D.C. Office of Human Rights. She joins us in studio. Monica, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Kim McDaniel is the Diversity Program Manager at the D.C. Fire and EMS Department. Kim McDaniel, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Monica, you work, as we mentioned, in the District's Office of Human Rights. When and why did protecting gender identity become a priority for the city?
Well, what I would love to start with is that the district has one of the most expansive and progressive anti-discrimination laws in the country. So around 2002, 2004, the discussions surfaced around adding gender identity and expression as protected traits. So currently we have 19 going on 20 protected traits. And since 2006, gender identity and expression have been two of those protected traits. Since then, we've done extensive work to make sure that people understand what this means. What practical protection does this offer? So one very vivid example that's discussed a lot around the country is the access to a bathroom. If an individual chooses to use a restroom identified, you know, for males or females, how do we protect that individual in choosing where they feel safe to use the restroom in a public facility? So that's one example, but there are many other examples. Ensuring that the proper pronouns are used in the workplace so that an individual does not feel harassed, so that it doesn't create a hostile work environment.
Speaking of pronouns, we got an email from Elizabeth who asks, why is the pronoun they used instead of creating a gender-neutral singular pronoun, Nick?
There actually are a number of gender-neutral pronouns that are being used. And they, when I say they, it's being talked about as a singular pronoun, although you would say they are. There's slight alteration, which is that usually people say themselves rather than themselves when they're using they as a singular. There's other pronoun sets like ze, here, hears, herself, or ze, zeerself, and there are quite a few others. What I have personally found is that, you know, going with they and them pronouns is easier for me because a lot of people are familiar with they and them.
And they don't want to learn new words.
Right. So, but, you know, there are other folks who go by other pronoun sets, and I want to respect that as well.
Monica, what steps did your office take to get other D.C. government offices in compliance with accepting non-binary gender identities?
Well, we've worked very closely with the district's office of with DCRA to ensure that new businesses understand if they have a single-user restroom, for example, in their new restaurant or whatever business they're starting, that that restroom has to be labeled as gender neutral. So that also has to align with, you know, building codes, inspections, to make sure that we're all on the same page. So we've worked closely with DCRA. We've worked closely with other
agencies. For those
of
you new to the district, the capital of acronyms, you should know that DCRA is the Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs. Go ahead,
Yes. So we've worked with the Department of General Services, which is the district government's own management of its properties. And just 2 months ago, the Reeves Center had its first multi-gender bathroom installed, and we'll be having one of those installed in at One Judiciary Square very soon as well.
Kim, as we mentioned, you work in the city's Fire and Emergency Services Department, where you wrote the policy on gender identity and expression. What does that policy say, and what does it require of employees at your department?
So I started working on this policy about a year ago, which a little after I joined the department. And I saw the need for it because when I would do trainings, there was just a lot of culture shock to it, this whole notion. And so I felt it was really important that we had a policy and something that I could use as I rolled out training. But essentially, it's all about respect. When you are a first responder and you encounter a patient, you have to respect how that patient wants to be identified. And to the extent that you need to document the birth gender, you can put that on the medical report so that the hospital has that information. But you have to continue to respect and speak to that individual how they want to be spoken to and identified as.
What's the history of your department's relationship with the city's trans and non-binary community?
Well,
In particular, tell us the Tyra Hunter story.
Yeah, so the Tyra Hunter is a very touching story and one that our department is not proud of course.
But
it happened. It happened about 20 years ago, and Tyra Hunter was a well-respected entrepreneur in the city. She was involved in a car accident, you know, the jury found that our department did not treat her with respect. Found some problems at DC General in terms of how she was treated as well. So from a medical standpoint, she may not have been given the best care and also not respected. So it is something that, we are not proud of and that we've had to do a lot of training over the years. And I think this policy, I was very, very glad that the mayor put out a directive to all D.C. government agencies that we need to have this policy. One of the things that I did when I first came on is I called a lot of the fire departments around the country to try and find out if other departments had such a policy and if they could share it with me. And I was really surprised to learn that a lot of the major cities do not have such a policy within their fire departments and police departments. So I'm really glad that we have it. And I think it is being well received. Some trainings that I recently did, I could see that, people were accepting it more and getting used to this new cultural piece.
Well, a lot has changed over the years. I was looking at the Washington Post article about Tyra Hunter in 1995. The article says that Tyra Hunter announced at age 15 that he was gay and decided 2 years later to live as a woman. Despite that, the rest of the article refers to Tyra Hunter as he. So I doubt whether that would occur in 2017. Right. We've got to take a short break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation, but you can still join it by calling 800-433-8850. Do you struggle with accepting the gender identity of your friends or your family members? What questions do you have about gender identity? 800-433-8850 or send us a tweet at Kojo Show. Email to kojo@wamu.org. I'm Kojo Namdi.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back to our conversation that was initiated by the District of Columbia starting to issue non-binary driver's licenses. We're talking with Nick Sakurai. He is the Director of Leadership Initiatives at the University of Maryland College Park's LGBT Equity Center. Monica Palacio is the Director of D.C.'s Office of Human Rights, and Kim McDaniel is the Diversity Program Manager at D.C. Fire and EMS. We got an email from Lauren who said some trans and non-gendered friends have had specific troubles while getting medical attention. Hopefully a more appropriate gender marker on their IDs will help. Also, that local medical professionals receive training on how to best serve their patients. Also, big props to Whitman Walker for always helping the community navigate these tricky issues. Nick, I was about to ask you, what does the story of Tyra Hunter say to you? But I guess it says to you a little bit about what Lauren has been talking about.
I mean, I think I came to D.C. in 2003, and the story about Tyra Hunter was in the front of my mind. And, I've seen trans folks and gender nonconforming people who've been murdered in the city, including people who were coworkers at my own employer. And there's a lot of fear, legitimate fear about violence in the city. And at the same time, trans folks have talked a lot about how, finding yourself in a healthcare setting or finding yourself in a prison or jail are some of the scariest places that you could possibly be as a trans person. And I think we've had some change. And I'm hopeful about some of the new requirements around healthcare professionals and training and LGBT issues, but also what's been happening with putting out new policies that really make people aware about some of these human rights regulations we've had for over a decade.
Kim McDaniel, you were not working for DC and Fire EMS back in 1995. I'm not even sure the department had a diversity program manager at that point, but can you tell us what the department has learned since that incident?
I think that the department has learned that continuous training. We can never do enough of it. Mandatory training, which we have for all of our members. And I think that this policy will go a long way as well. You know, we're a paramilitary environment, and it's an environment that's used to rules and regulations. And so I think the members, when they see something as a policy and as a directive, they will, you know, follow it. But it's going to take time. Not of all of our members come from Washington, D.C., where I think it's more accepted. We have members that come in from West Virginia, parts of Pennsylvania, and some of those are rural areas. So, you know, when I get up in front of a class and I'm talking about the LGBTQ issues and trying to train them in all the laws and the bathroom breaks and the bathroom issues, it's really difficult for them culturally. So we've got to just really continue to do a really good job of training. And when I do the trainings, I like an open discussion, because I think me standing up there and saying, you know, this is the policy and live with it, that's not going to help. So it really helps, I think, to get discussion generated where they can openly feel free to ask me questions and to make comments such that they know they're not going to be in trouble over it.
On to the telephones. Here is Ruth in Washington, D.C. Ruth, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Oh, thanks. I was just listening and wondering, why do we even need a gender box on our driver's licenses? I think it's not going to be relevant in almost any circumstance. And when it is relevant, it could be answered by asking the person. And I think, I'm thinking that in the case of birth certificates, there used to be places to put down whether someone was legitimate or born out of wedlock, and they don't do that anymore. And I'm sure that there's a lot of stuff changing about where people have to put down race. Mainly aware of the Census Bureau's changes.
Well, allow me to have Monica Palacio respond to your initial question.
Well, I would just repeat what Nick stated beautifully earlier, is that this is a government-sanctioned ID. For some people, it is important for that to be a recognized, valid part of the way they identify. But I agree with the caller. I think this is something that we may be evolving away from. I'm sure the DMV has reasons for this, but they may be archaic. You know, we can always take a look at that.
Whether it's an... Go ahead, Nick.
I mean, I definitely hope that introducing the X gender marker, certainly it gives more options for people, but I do hope to see gender become less important as a legal category. Certainly it matters as a social category and for demographic data collection and research. But as far as like saying, here, I have to prove with some document this is what my gender is, we don't have to I don't prove what my race is. I don't have it listed on any document. Although my parents' races are listed on my birth certificate, you know, and so some places have gone to removing race from birth certificates, mm-hmm. for example. And so yes, I think that's a good question. Nothing in D.C. law requires it to be on a driver's license. However, there is a regulation that requires it, and the Real ID Act requires it. And they both use the term gender, even though the licenses and IDs say the word sex on them.
On to Jay in Washington, D.C. Jay, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Hey, Kojo and everybody else. Thank you so much for having the show and for inviting me on the air. I just wanted to highlight the fact that this is a really important time for me. I think I was third in line yesterday to get the X designation, and want to speak to how important that is into affirming me and having something I can reference, whether it's, you know, even using a bathroom or that might still be gendered, going to a bar and having my ID checked, going to the doctor and being able to have a real conversation when I receive healthcare. But I also want to highlight the fact that I know a lot of folks in my life who have a lot less privilege than I do, who are very nervous about receiving an ID like this. And what I mean by that is I'm a white human. I also typically express my gender identity in more of an androgynous or masculine way. And I'm not going to have the same fear of or reality of retaliation and violence that could face somebody, you know, who is Black, who's brown, who's more femme-presenting, who's an immigrant, who's disabled, or, you know, holding a whole other host of marginalized identities. So I just want to, you know, highlight that and make sure that we are working not only in D.C., but across the country to really create those protections legally and create that education that is really required in this moment to allow all folks to live their truths and be recognized.
Thank you very much for your call, Jay. A bit of informed speculation here. Whether it's on an emergency call or a bar entrance or an airport security line, IDs are often the first thing checked for security or verification. How can security be both, on the one hand, respectful of varying gender identities and, on the other hand, maintain protection standards? I'm thinking in particular of airports where, based on your identified gender, you go into one thing or another, which apparently looks at your body parts to decide whether you are, in fact, the person you say you are. Care to comment on that, Monica?
I would say that this is an area that we need to explore through culture change and behavior change. So the X marker, to me, opens the conversation for individuals to start to understand that we have very rigid constructs in terms of what who presents as male and who presents as female. I think that we see in, you know, law enforcement, and I would equate that to security, we need to be able to train individuals to think outside of these constructs and be respectful, whatever they encounter, and to be able to manage their own feelings and their reactions when they do encounter an individual that might be different or present in a way that they're not used to.
Well, we got an email from Leslie, who asks, what percentage of the general population of America refer to themselves as non-binary? How many people does this affect? A similar issue can be found in the deaf culture, also in Washington, D.C., with the expectation that American Sign Language be accepted as a cultural norm. I get the impression that this is someone who opposes this. Any figures at all on the size of populations?
Well, I might defer to Nick on this, but the research I've seen says that about 10% of the population in the United States identify privately or publicly as LGBT and LGBTQ. So that's the number I would use.
Yeah. And I think from Jay, who had called in, I wanted to also echo, you know, there's a lot of privileges associated, I think, with being an early adopter, and a lot of issues that I think folks who choose the X marker at first are gonna face. As far as population, though, we've seen some studies from Gallup, for example, that people of color are more likely to identify as LGBT than white people. We've also seen in a study that people of color were more likely to identify as non-binary than white people as well. Non-binary could mean lots of things. If you're talking about sex specifically, you might be thinking about intersex people, which some have estimated as 1.7% of the population. If you're talking about trans people, we need to keep in mind that trans people are not just non-binary people, that there are men and women and people who have M and F and want M or F on their ID who are trans. And so, you know, the issue of adding an X is not going to solve security line issues, profiling of people, mistreating of people. And in my view, what your gender is, you know, legally shouldn't really be a thing, and that should not cause you to face problems in a security line.
Some more of the pushback that I saw on Reddit. I don't have compassion for the hundreds and growing self-created genders people make up to try to feel special. If the government is going to legitimize these fantasies, it won't be too long till people start filing federal discrimination lawsuits because they're amica gender or crypto gender. How would you respond to that, Nick?
I'm not sure what the last bit meant.
I looked it up.
Okay.
Oh, but that doesn't mean I can explain exactly what it meant.
Look,
I do know it's a term.
So, I don't know. There have been, so as I said at the beginning, there have been cultures, you know, in among Native American indigenous communities in North America, there have been over 130 tribes where there's been, you know, research that has shown that they have understood that three or more genders, at least historically, right? And so in a process of colonization, a lot of genders have disappeared over time. And for people to either come up with new terms or reclaim identities that relate to their own culture, my own being from Japan, you know, it's important that, like, we respect this from a cultural perspective. I think there are lots of different people with many, 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 many different genders. And as far as, like, negative comments generally, I saw some comments on a CNN video this morning that were just horrifying, where, like, 800 people were liking a comment about how, you know, we should be basically put in a mental institution and given drugs. And then somebody else commented on that, that actually we should be executed. And so I think there are some serious human rights concerns with some of the responses to this. But it also says to me that there's a deep, deep ignorance. People need to Google and Wikipedia things like gender systems, third gender. There's a lot of history behind this.
I'll let Joseph in Vienna, Virginia, have the last word. Joseph, you're on the air. Go ahead, please.
Thank you, Peter, for taking my call. I think that the D.C. government have taken a very bold and important step in doing what they've done because, excuse me, I think that a lot of people take gender identity for granted. And I'm sure some people will think that this is like liberal politics gone crazy. But for me, and those would probably say political correctness has gone crazy. But political correctness is nothing other than treating other people with respect. So I just hope that the D.C. government have paved the way for other states to follow, so we can all move forward and be a progressive and better country.
Well, all I can say, Joseph, is we shall see. Thank you very much for your call.
Kim? I just want to add one thing. You know, a lot of people don't know, but Washington, D.C. is one of the cities that's the fastest growing for the transgender community. So I think it's really important that we do have the laws to protect and that our law enforcement, fire emergency medical services really get the training that they need, because reality, it is the fastest growing. A lot of people don't realize that.
Kim McDaniel, she is the Diversity Program Manager at DC Fire and EMS. Monica Palacio is the Director of DC's Office of Human Rights. And Nick Sakurai is the Director of Leadership Initiatives at the University of Maryland College Park's LGBT Equity Center. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Take a short break. When we come back, we'll explore how D.C.'s food scene is changing neighborhoods in the city and in the suburbs. I'm Kojo Namdi.
Thanks for listening to The Kojo Namdi Show, and if you're already a member of WAMU 88.5, thank you for your support. If not, it's easy to give online at wamu.org. Just click the donate button, and thanks.